From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump touched down in Charlotte, North Carolina today to speak to delegates after securing the 1,276 votes it's needed to secure that renomination. The president's remarks kicking off the first day of the Republican National Convention.
We will keep an eye on that. But of course, there's another big story today on Capitol Hill. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy is testifying before the House Oversight Committee, saying that he wants to correct inaccuracies about what he's done since taking the helm at the post office in June.
First, I did not direct the removal of blue collection boxes or the removal of mail processing equipment. Second, I did not direct the cutback on hours at any of our post offices. And finally, I did not direct the elimination or any cutback in overtime.
DeJoy's testimony comes after he made cost-saving operational changes that have been blamed for widespread delays in the mail and have Democrats worried about the ability of the post office to handle election ballots in November. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales has been following the hearing, and she joins us now. Claudia, we just heard DeJoy say that he did not ask for cutbacks in overtime or the removal of collection boxes, but on the other hand, there have been reports of those things happening. So what did we learn today? What is true?
So he did reiterate those points that he hasn't been tied to any of those reports of these sorting machines, for example, being taken offline. However, we heard from Democrats saying that they believe he's not being transparent and forthcoming about what's really going on at the post office. He did admit he has suspended some of these practices they asked about. He also said in terms of the sorting machines, he said the post office needs a lot more funding. They're going to lose more than $10 billion this year. So at one point he was saying, get me the funding, I'll put the machines back in, getting them back online. And so there were also some comments by him that he has been disconnected from some of these reports. He says he wasn't aware of some of the practices at the Postal Service, and he reiterated how long he's been on the job, just a little more than 2 months, and he's just catching up to some operational standards. And Democrats raised concern. He's in charge, and he should know of the requests coming and going and some of these machines that have gone offline and what's also needed to come online as soon as possible.
The Washington Post is reporting that, yes, the post office does regularly decommission mail sorting machines, but there are bigger than usual reductions this year, which is an election year. Did he make any comments about that?
No, I didn't hear any in terms of the hearing itself. They've covered a lot of the same ground that we heard Friday when he testified before a Senate panel on this. And in terms of some new details there, those have been hard to come by today.
All right, Louis DeJoy, a logistics executive before he got to this job. Also, though, a Trump donor, Republican fundraiser. And he was asked if he was delaying the mail to help the president. Here's an exchange with Democratic Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee.
Do your mail delays fit Trump's campaign goal of hurting the post office, as stated in his tweets?
Are your mail delays implicit campaign contributions? These types of questions. I'm here to represent the Postal Service. It has nothing to do with all my actions have to do with improvement into the Postal Service.
Meanwhile, Republicans are also claiming that there's political interference. But from Democrats, here's Congressman Jim Jordan, a Republican of Ohio, talking about DeJoy's background.
You got an amazing history of community service. You help kids with their education. You serve your community, serve our country, and these people are out to get you. When all the facts, none of the facts, as the Wall Street Journal said, this is one giant conspiracy from the Democrats.
So what about that? Is there any evidence at all that these moves were political and that they were intended to somehow help the president's reelection?
So DeJoy has been very firm here today, pushing back on any kind of references that this is politically motivated. He said that is not the case at all. But as you mentioned, he is a Trump donor, and he and his wife have a history of donating to conservative causes, Republican candidates, including more than $1 million to President Trump's election efforts. And so he's also heavily active with the Republican Party. So those questions have been raised, but he has been very firm today, pushing back on those claims that he is making these decisions on a political basis.
And just briefly, over the weekend, Democrats in the House approved $25 billion for the Postal Service. 26 Republicans supported that bill, but it doesn't look like that has much of a chance going forward, does it? Is the Postal Service going to get any more money anytime soon?
Not anytime soon. We should note that this amount was appropriated in the HEROES Act, which is the new proposal from Democrats from the last few months on pandemic relief aid. It hasn't been approved there. That bill hasn't had much traction. And in this case, Senate Republicans have already said they would not take up this bill, and President Trump has already threatened to veto it if they did.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Dangerous fires in California continue to burn, and firefighters there are now getting help from other states. Crews made some progress over the weekend on three huge groups of fires that are burning near the San Francisco Bay Area. But more summer heat and lightning strikes could complicate efforts. Joining us now is Daniel Berlant, Assistant Deputy Director at CAL FIRE. Chief, welcome back. So hundreds of fires are burning. They are threatening tens of thousands of homes and other structures. We actually spoke to you on Friday about this firefight, and you called it an uphill battle. How would you describe the situation today?
Well, we've continued to see a significant number of wildfires across the state. Fortunately, the weather has been cooperating with us. In fact, overnight, our temperatures were relatively cooler. We actually saw a little bit of rainfall. And even though we were bracing for additional lightning strikes overnight and into today, we didn't see as many as we had forecast. So fortunately, we are continuing to make good progress, and we have not seen that many more fires.
What additional resources is California requesting right now to fight these fires, and how are those requests being met?
Well, right now there are over 14,000 firefighters on nearly two dozen major fires, but we're continuing to lean on a number of our state partners around the U.S., specifically in the West, but we have requests out really for the entire nation. We have 78 fire engines on scene from Western states, and we have several hundred additional pending requests that we're looking for. We've also brought in the National Guard and even several National Guards from other states helping us towards this fight. But with the fact that historically it's September and October when we experience our largest and our most damaging wildfires, to have so many fires burn so many acres already, this may be an unfortunate sign of what's to come.
You know, Sonoma County Supervisor Linda Hopkins said at a briefing today that one thing people can do who are not impacted by these fires is to support small businesses. Let's listen.
They've been hit hard by fires, floods, pandemic, and then now again, these mandatory evacuations. So I think the more that we can, support local restaurants with takeout, the more we can purchase local gift cards, all of those kinds of things to get our economy back going. Because, this is unfortunately when those small businesses make or break it is over the summer. And so having these impacts will be very substantial on our small businesses.
Chief Berlant, I know that you all are so focused on fighting these fires, but what else can we do to help those being impacted by the fires there?
95% of the wildfires that we respond to in an average year are caused by the activity of people. And so it is so critical that our own residents and, under other circumstances, when we have visitors from other states, we need everybody to take extra precautions outdoors to prevent sparking a wildfire. Most fires are preventable. And so while we are incredibly busy with Mother Nature sparked fires, we cannot afford one more fire.
You know, I'm also wondering how you and crews are holding up. This is all happening where you live, your loved ones live. We're in the midst of a pandemic. You all are trying to gain other resources. This is an unprecedented moment. How are you all doing?
Many of our firefighters have been on the front lines of fires for several weeks in a row. Even before this lightning siege occurred just over a week ago, we had been on several major fires down in Southern California. So many of our firefighters are being released from those other fires and moved up to fires in Northern California. So we are holding all personnel on duty. And so it has been definitely a very long start to the summer. As I mentioned, with really no end in sight and with us just getting really to the peak of fire season, we are doing our best to ensure that our firefighters are motivated, that they have morale is well, because we are in for a long summer and a long fall.
You know, one last question for you. I mean, you all have so much that you're dealing with, but we're also reading reports of looting going on and fire evacuation zones near Santa Cruz. There have been several arrests already, but One person who'd had their wallet stolen was a fire commander working on a fire. I mean, this just complicates things for you all as people are kind of putting themselves in danger to be thieves, and all of this is coming at the same time. What's your message there to the public about this?
You know, regardless of your motives, whether you're trying to stay behind to try to protect your home, whether you're stubborn and don't want to evacuate, or whether you're a criminal and looking for an opportunity, at the end of the day, these areas are just too dangerous to be in, and we need people to stay away. Now, we work very closely with our law enforcement partners who bring in police and sheriff's department officials from all over the state to help ensure that the homes that are evacuated are secure.
Thank you so much. Daniel Berlant, Assistant Deputy Director at CAL FIRE. Thank you so much for your time. Stay safe.
President Trump accepted the Republican presidential nomination today as the party's convention kicked off in person in Charlotte, North Carolina. In an impromptu speech, the president accused Democrats of trying to steal the election by promoting mail-in ballots during the pandemic.
Be very, very careful. This is going to be, and I really believe this, this is the most important election in the history of our country.
Yeah, it is.
Don't let them take it away from you.
The live event was a stark contrast from the all-virtual Democratic National Convention last week. Let's bring in our political strategist. We've got Alice Stewart, who is a Republican. It's good to have you back.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Sure. And Bill Press is the Democrat. Hello to you.
Hello, Peter. Hi, Alice.
All right, so Alice, we are going to start with you because, hey, this is your convention. It's underway, and I guess, you know, you're both either sort of a mix of nervous or excited because here we are. The general election is sort of officially underway now. Alice, how are you feeling? What have you heard so far today?
Well, so far, it's off to a great start. Is this clearly going to be an unconventional convention just like it was last week? I was encouraged to see the president take the time to go and speak to those at the convention to tell them thank you for your work and support and really get it started with a show of unity and the fact that he really wants to continue four more years. And as he has made the case, as well as the vice president made the case, it's time to make America great again. And it was nice to see him to show a positive message, one of encouragement and unity, bringing the party together. But Peter and Bill, as you both know, politics is a game of addition, and we not only have to ignite the base that are at the convention this week and last week, but broaden the tent and bring in the undecided voters, and that's the goal for Republicans this week.
So, Bill, I want to get your reaction in just a minute, but to that point, Alice, how inclusive will this convention really be? Because already today we heard the president warning that Democrats are out to steal the election. He essentially said that if he loses, the election will have been rigged. And I don't know if you noticed, but the first thing he said when he came out to address supporters in Charlotte was, hey, if you really want to drive them crazy, don't chant four more years, chant 12 more years. That sounds like it's much more dire than inclusive, Alice.
That sounds a lot like he's really energizing the base and getting them excited about taking part in this election, but also 2024 and after. Look, Peter, I'll be the first one to say Republicans and Democrats across the board, we need to make sure and instill with voters that we want free and fair elections. We also want them secure and one of integrity. And I don't like either side questioning the integrity of the election in November. We need to do what we can to make sure that everything is done fairly. But to try and cast doubt on the outcome right now, I think is not a proper way to move forward. And I think clearly what we're going to see this week in terms of broadening the tent, the themes that the Republicans have outlined, the land of promise, the land of heroes, of opportunity and greatness, we'll hear from a cross-section of Republicans and people across this country that will really inspire people to get out and vote for Donald Trump as opposed to just voting against the opposition, which is what we saw from the Democrats.
So, Bill Press, the Democrat here, do you like hearing these kinds of messages from the president? Because, you know, maybe it doesn't appear that he's branching out from his base. Or are you thinking, this is the same kind of messaging that got Trump elected 4 years ago, and it could happen again?
Well, the first thing I feel is a little pity for the Republicans, because I think after the Democratic convention, they have a hard act to follow. And what we saw from what we saw today, I don't think they're going to come close. Look, I don't see how anybody, not even my friend Alice, could say that it's off to a great start. This roll call was ridiculous. So it's the same old format with boring people at the podium, no creativity, unlike the Democratic convention, which was that very fun, exciting romp around the country. These people stood there. They gave their same old spiel in the middle of the day when nobody is watching. And then the president arrives. He didn't do anything to reach out to the base. He spoke for twice as long as Joe Biden spoke in his acceptance speech, and 99% of it was ranting about mail ballots, about absentee ballots, which have been used in this country since the Civil War when Union soldiers voted by absentee. That whole approach, Chuck Todd on NBC, right after the president finished, said, if we gave you took the truth of what the president just said in 50 minutes, we would probably be limited to one sentence. There were so many untruths about, as you pointed out, Peter, the president's message was, Democrats are trying to steal this election. This election is rigged unless I win. And that was his entire message. Finally, let me add one other thing. I think it should be noted that the Republican Party is having its convention and not adopting any platform. This is no longer a party of ideas. They are saying that. They've admitted, we have no ideas, we have no principles, we have no platform, we have no agenda. We are the party of Donald Trump, period. That's what this convention is all about. That's what we're all about. And whatever he wants to do, it's okay with us.
So, Alice, I do want you to respond to that. Hold on, let me just jump in there real quick. I do want you to respond to that. But to the point that this was sort of the same old boring convention, as Bill says, his words, that it was just like past conventions. Alice, isn't that the point that the Trump administration wanted to say, hey, look, you know, life can go back to normal and, you know, we're not so worried about the pandemic and the economy and that sort of thing? I mean, maybe it was part of the strategy, Alice.
Well, sure. Let me just say to my dear friend Bill, to save his pity party for the Democrats in November, the Grand Old Party doesn't need it. And look, truthfully, any vote that's up for grabs is not going to be decided based on whether or not there was a live roll call out in the states or a taped roll call out in the states or live or taped roll call from the convention hall. It's not going to make a big impact on those swing voters or up for grab voters that they're really trying to reach for. And to correct Bill with regard to no platform and no principles or policies, we're going to hear this week exactly that, key principles that the Republican Party is focused on and will continue to work on, including jobs, what they're going to do to eradicate COVID, ending our reliance on China, working on health care, draining the swamp. And another key point that I was glad to see the president touch on today was defending our police, not defunding our police, which is what the Democrats want to do, but making sure to restore law and order, which is critical.
Well, careful, Alice. Do not repeat Donald Trump's lies, please. Joe Biden has said, he said again on ABC last night, he does not support defunding the police. He has a program to give more money to the police. So let's be clear. And also, the point I made was the Republican convention has decided they are not going to adopt a platform. You cannot dispute that. That is a fact because they're not putting out any ideas and no agenda. And by the way, Donald Trump spoke for 50 minutes today. And I was waiting to see, as Karl Rove himself said, Donald Trump has to put forth and tell the American people why you should give me another 4 years, what I will do with another 4 years. He did not do that today. All he did was warn about carnage in the streets and a rigged ballot. What about that point, Alice?
Four nights of this convention, we expect to hear from Donald Trump every night. That was a very long speech that we just heard him give today. I mean, at a certain point, do you think people just kind of tune him out?
I think this was, as I said, unconventional. And what we will hear throughout the week is more fleshing out of the policies and principles of this party. And look, the decision clearly has been made to flood the zone with Donald Trump. He is the face and voice and leader of this party. And I think that's a good call. And to all of those concerns that Bill has, We have 4 days to flesh it out and to outline how this president and this party will go about making America great again for 4 more years. And it's only just begun. And I'm encouraged to see a lot of the speakers, but most importantly, Herschel Walker, the former Georgia Bulldog, is going to be speaking. And I, for one, am excited about that.
Hey, clearly, let's just talk quickly, Pete. I just have to say one other thing missing today. Almost no mention of COVID. Almost no mention of it. The only thing Donald Trump kept saying is we saved millions of lives, ignoring the fact that almost 180,000 Americans have died as of today because of Donald Trump's incompetence in leading the response to COVID-19. He didn't even talk about it.
Well, look, it will be interesting to juxtapose those two conventions to see how they each treat that issue differently. But I do want to talk about what will happen after the convention. Joe Biden and his running mate, Kamala Harris, you mentioned this earlier. On ABC last night, Biden was pushing back on the president's claims that he's losing it mentally and that he won't come out of his basement to campaign.
Guess what? I have left my basement. But here, in the meantime, 500 million people have watched what I've done out of my basement. And guess what? People are listening.
Bill, I'm going to leave it with you because we don't have too much time. Are you concerned that the two candidates will have vastly different campaign strategies here? Trump probably going to be pressing the flesh more with real in-person voters.
I think what you're going to see is Joe Biden with a very and Kamala Harris with a very positive, forward-looking campaign of what they would bring to the White House, how they would get the country back on track. And I think you're going to see continued personal attacks by Donald Trump. That's who he is. That's all he's good at. I don't think the American people will buy it.
Okay, Al Stewart, we're going to have you back on at some point to give you the final word here. Al Stewart, a Republican strategist, and Bill Press, the Democrat. Thanks to you both for a nice conversation. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Details are now emerging in the shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man who was shot multiple times in the back by police last night in Kenosha, Wisconsin. In a bystander's video, Blake is seen walking toward his car before an officer opens fire while Blake has his back turned to him. The officers involved have been placed on leave. Meanwhile, the shooting prompted widespread protests in the city last night. For more, let's bring in LaToya Dennis with Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. Welcome.
Thank you.
And as far as we can tell from that video, what happened just before police shot Jacob Blake? What do we know?
You know, it's been said that Jacob Blake was on the scene because there were two women who were involved in a verbal altercation. Now, bystanders said that he was trying to break that up, and we didn't see that on video. What we do see is police are on the scene. Blake walks around his vehicle to the driver's side door, opens it, and he appears to try and get in. A police officer grabs the back of his shirt and then begins to fire. That police officer fired about 7 shots. When Blake was shot, it's been said by his fiance that his 3 children were in the vehicle, and so they watched this happen. The civil rights attorney, Ben Crump, has verified this.
And the reaction is pretty swift, because soon afterward, people start to gather at the scene. Protests begin that go on for hours. What happens next?
Absolutely. You know, people gathered at that scene, 60 to 100 people, maybe more. And they marched to basically City Hall, which is where the county courthouse is. And it's where the police administration building is. And by the time they got there, there were already, you know, roadblocks that were put up to try and keep people from getting too close to the buildings. Many of those trucks were set on fire, windows were broken, and there was a lot of damage that was done. And protesters were met by police in riot gear, who at some point, several times throughout the night, did fire tear gas into the crowd and rubber bullets.
Of course, this is very reminiscent to protests that we've seen throughout the country over the last couple of months. And the governor there, Tony Evers, a Democrat, weighed in on this shooting. He condemned it, even though he also acknowledged in a tweet that all the details of the case are not yet known. What more can you tell us about what the governor is saying today and what the political reaction has been?
You know, some people have said that we don't have all the details and that the governor shouldn't yet be speaking on this whatsoever. But from the community has said you know, that some of them are applauding the governor for his stance of saying, you know, Black lives do matter and that we shouldn't see this sort of violence from police officers. But I think most people just want to see justice. And when they say justice, especially the people who are out there protesting, they want to see the officer not only fired, but they want to see him charged and they want to see him, you know, go to prison.
And just briefly, what does happen next with the investigation?
So right now, the State Department of Justice is investigating this, and they say that they strive to have a report to prosecution within 30 days, and then from there, it's up to, you know, the prosecutors as to how long they take to make public their decision.
All right, I'm sure we'll be in touch as that process plays out. LaToya Dennis with Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
During difficult times, attending church services can be a source of comfort for many. But this pandemic has laid bare what can happen when people don't meet in person. Many churches have seen a big decline in tithing, and without this key source of funding, thousands of churches may be forced to close. For more, let's bring in David Kinnaman, president of Barna Group, a research agency in Ventura, California, focused on the intersection of faith and culture. David, welcome.
Oh, I'm so glad to be with you.
So, David, one thing Barna Group does is collect a lot of data on churches, for churches. You all actually put out a survey called The State of the Church that asked faith leaders, mostly Protestant, how they're doing. What exactly is the state of the church in 2020?
Well, at the beginning of the year, things were going along pretty swimmingly, at least as far as faith communities go. But what's happened since the pandemic is that, you know, everything has gone digital. Now, a bit of that has recovered. And in the last couple of months, more and more churches are reopening, but they're opening up with a lot less people coming. And they're recognizing that the relationships that they thought were much deeper with people were actually not as deep as they expected.
Mm. I want to ask you specifically about the financial hit that many churches are taking. Give us a sense of how much churches rely on tithing specifically or weekly donations, and how much these have dropped off because of the pandemic?
Well, it was the area that was hit hardest right at the very beginning. The vast majority of America's 300,000 plus congregations, which is a remarkable number, Protestant congregations and nearly 14,000 Catholic communities, they are quite dependent upon donations from congregants. I mean, that's really their engine, their financial engine is donations on a weekly basis from people who are generous in that way.
Yeah. Some churches have received small business loans under the CARES Act, but even with this relief, you actually said earlier this year that one in five churches could close in the next 18 months. Is that still what the data that you all have collected is telling you?
It is. If anything, I think that prediction was based on data about two and a half months ago, and I think we're even more likely to see that to be the case today. We're looking at things like people's confidence that their congregation will survive, and so we ask pastors every week, how likely do you believe that your congregation can survive this whole pandemic? And early on, it was actually over 70%. Who said they felt very confident, but now that number is 58% of pastors who feel very confident that their church will survive. You know, the disruptions related to giving, and maybe even as important to all of that is that even for those churches that have reopened, they're seeing much smaller numbers of people show up. So simply reopening a church doesn't sort of fix the underlying economic challenges that you might have as a congregation. And, you know, in the long run, I think we'll look back at this pandemic as a fundamental change to the way Americans both attend church. You know, obviously there'll be a lot more online attendance than ever before, even after all churches reopen. I think this sort of digital church is sort of here to stay. And I think it's also going to really change the way people think about their donation relationship with local churches as well. They'll have to be even greater demonstration of the value that a church brings, not just to those who attend, but also those who are part of its community.
David Kinnaman is president of Barna Group, a research agency focused on the intersection of faith and culture, talking to us about the state of churches right now. David, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And let's check in now on a church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the historic Vernon AME. With 134 members, Pastor Robert Turner there says it's a shell of its former self compared to its heyday during the Black Wall Street era, when the neighborhood was the wealthiest Black community in the country. That was before the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, when white mobs killed hundreds in the community and razed the surrounding buildings, except for Vernon AME. Now, they are in a different fight for their lives, and Pastor Turner joins us now. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you so much, Tanya, for having me.
And I want to ask you about how your church is doing financially. Have you also seen tithing and offerings take a hit, as we've heard so many churches are experiencing right now?
Absolutely. Because most of the members who we have today joined during the heyday, they are now old. They're very, you know, they're senior citizens. And we have live stream every Sunday. But most of our members, some of them don't even have an email address, let alone try to get on the website to do live streaming. And so our finances have taken a huge blow. And what Vernon has been able to do, especially since COVID, is find other ways to help, right? And that's one of the things that I'm really excited about, what we've been able to do in these past few months.
And that includes a food program for members that are outside of the church. This speaks to just how important churches are in communities, because you're serving your members, but you're also serving the community. Can you tell us a little about this feeding program?
Well, what happened to this world when COVID-19 pandemic really hit hard, that Monday before March 18th, I was sleeping. God woke me up out of my sleep and said, "Hey, I want you to feed my people." And I was like, "What?" And I didn't understand it. The next morning, because it was late when he woke me up, that Tuesday morning, I called my church treasurer and was like, "Hey, God told me we need to still feed." And he said, "How many folk are you trying to feed?" I said, 50 is good, you know. He said, "Well, we should be able to find some money for 50 people. We, Ms. Mosley, put the food out on Wednesday. In 30 minutes, it was gone. The need was just that great. And Vernon, this old church, you know, Grandmother Greenwood, Basement Survived the Massacre, has been the only structure open every day since COVID-19 hit. We've given out now nearly 140,000 meals. Mm. A church of just 134 members. And I'm not embarrassed to say last year our operating budget was only $200,000. And to show you just how awesome God's personality is and how big his grace is, the largest demographic of people we serve food to are white men. The same demographic of folk who bombed and killed and dumped bodies from the 1921 race massacre in mass graves.
I mean, this is really powerful. What you're saying is that you're serving this purpose in a community at a time when you all need so much help, and you're serving a community of people that several generations ago tried to take away your place in the community. Where do you see yourself going from here?
I what's next is we're going to keep serving the food ministry program. We didn't even have a name for it. We just started calling it a feeding program. But once it started, you know, God gave me the idea to just call it what it is. The God Provides Feeding Ministry. And he has truly provided. We have not received any grants for this or any money. We've received in-kind contributions and financial donations to this. This ministry is bringing in more money than our tithes and offerings. We have a pantry filled with food. Meanwhile, we're struggling to pay just our operating expenses, our utility bills, because our power has been on every day. Our water is being utilized every day. And so where do we go from here? We will continue to trust. This is not the worst. Unfortunately, this is not the worst that Vernon has seen. I see churches as places that are not closed on a stone. Churches are refuges, the Bible teaches. God is a refuge, and a refuge doesn't close during a storm. They're open, you know, and there are places people go during a storm. And so that's just how I see the body. And even though we got major needs, we still have something we can give.
That's Pastor Robert Turner speaking to us about his church, the historic Vernon AME in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and how they're faring during the pandemic. Pastor, thank you so much for your time, and my best to you and your congregants.
God bless you, and God keep you, and anytime you need me, I'm here.
School districts across the country are facing a lot of unknowns. One major question, whether teachers with health concerns have to return to school in person. New Hampshire Public Radio's Sarah Gibson caught up with three teachers in the Granite State who are figuring out how their districts will accommodate them and whether that will be enough.
Beth Frank has two families, her husband and relatives, and then what she calls her work family, the teachers and students at John Stark Regional High School in Ware, New Hampshire, where she runs the academic support program. She's the kind of teacher who keeps snacks for students in her desk, always knows what homework they owe and what they're struggling with at home.
Oh, many of the students call me Mama Frank. You know, I become their school mom. They call me school mom. Some just call me mom. Some call me Mama Frank.
Normally, Frank would be excited to see her work family again. But when she learned schools were planning to reopen,
I started panicking the minute I started thinking of having to return into the building.
Panic because Frank is high risk for COVID-19. Both she and her husband have underlying conditions that could lead to serious complications if they get the virus.
We don't intermingle out in public. We don't go into places. I can count maybe on one hand how many times I have actually gone out because of my risk.
Frank is in a conundrum that many teachers are facing. She loves her job, but returning feels too risky, even if the school institutes good safety measures. Frank's conditions are serious enough that she's working with her union and school district to get an accommodation under disability law. Her hope is to be matched virtually with students in the district who opt to learn remotely this year. For Frank, the options are clear. Either she gets permission to work remotely or she resigns. But for many other teachers, the decision is less black and white.
Can I have cheese, please?
Take the household of Kelly Bresnahan, a special ed teacher in New Hampshire's largest city, Manchester. She has two school-age kids and is raising her oldest child's kids as well. And there's a lot to juggle. Bresnahan herself has asthma, making her high risk for COVID-19. And her grandkids both have cystic fibrosis, CF, which makes their health fragile to begin with. They both take dozens of pills a day, and one uses a feeding tube.
The CF already causes them to have to fight every day. And then if they get COVID, to have to fight those side effects on top of the CF, it's just, ugh.
Going back to school introduces so many unknowns into this family's life. With her grandson sitting on her lap, Bresnahan wonders, is it possible to contract the virus from her first grade students? Do the educational benefits of in-person school for her kids and grandkids outweigh the risks?
Maybe I'm stressing out too much and it's not going to be that bad. Maybe it's perfectly normal for me to stress out and it's going to be bad. I don't know.
That's why Bresnahan is debating whether to keep her whole family home next year. She and her husband would oversee remote learning. And if her district allows it, she would work remotely too.
I want to work. I love working. So it makes me sad to have to take a leave of absence. I don't want this disease to win, you know, and take over my life and trap me.
And then there are the financial concerns. Trevor Duvall teaches high school in Hollis, New Hampshire. His wife has cancer and kidney disease, and he's terrified of bringing the virus home to her.
There's a level of guilt there that I don't think I would ever be able to forgive myself for.
Duval's options aren't great. Protections under disability law and coronavirus legislation don't do much for a teacher who's healthy but whose spouse is sick. He could take family medical leave, but...
We are a single-income family, so that really isn't a great option. I can request a leave of absence for a year, or I can resign, which means I have no income and no health insurance.
No insurance for his wife, who's undergoing cancer treatment. So there's a good chance Duval will go back to school. If he does, he and his wife will assess the district's safety guidelines and decide whether, for her health, he should stay in their finished basement and limit close contact with her for the year. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Gibson.
And we want to note some sad news now. The death of musician Justin Townes Earle. He released 8 albums during his career and was twice honored at the Americana Music Awards. On Here and Now in 2010, he talked about what it was like to be the son of a famous father, musician Steve Earle, and to be named after legendary singer-songwriter Townes Van Zandt.
You know, I knew really early on that anybody who decided that they were going to be in competition with Steve Earle and Townes Van Zandt for as a songwriter is going to live a fool's life. You know, you're whoever you are, and you got to learn who you are in order to write decent songs.
And he certainly did just that. Justin Townes Earle was 38. Here is Harlem River Blues. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.
When I'm going.